From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We know Thomas Jefferson for many things. The Declaration of Independence, the Louisiana Purchase, Monticello, Sally Hemings. Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer John Meacham asks us to look again at the philosopher founder's politics, at Jefferson's political skills. They may, he says, be useful for us right now, this hour on Point. John Meacham and political lessons from the life of Thomas Jefferson. You can join the conversation. Can we still take political lessons from the founders? What does Jefferson stand for to you? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is John Meacham, historian, former editor of Newsweek, now executive editor at Random House. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2009 for his biography of Andrew Jackson, American Lion. His big new biography of the country's third president is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. It's out today. John Meacham, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
You're telling the whole story, or much of it, of a life here, but the cast you put on it right from the title is Jefferson's management, his use of power. Why does your focus go there on this? There's so many facets to this man. Why that facet, John?
Because I think Jefferson himself sent us in the wrong direction, or at least in one direction as opposed to the fullness of his life, by putting on his tombstone, which he designed, that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, the author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, and the founder of the University of Virginia, thus sending posterity, pointing us in the direction of the world of ideas, I think partly because he thought that those ideas would be of greater perennial popularity than his political life, which had consumed him for 40 years at least, from 1769, when as a young man he became a Burgess of Virginia, through 1809, when he left after being the second two-term president of the United States. His life was spent in the pursuit of power and in the wielding of it in the public arena. And I think he shared something that we have ourselves even now, a kind of unease with politics, a sense that there's a world of philosophy and a world of ideas and a world of intellectual achievement, and then there's the world of politics and deal-making and bargaining that's somehow not quite quite up to snuff with the other. My own view is that if we don't see politics as a noble endeavor, then we're doomed not to do them very well.
Though he doesn't make that much easier for us if he leaves all that right off his tombstone, does he?
Well, he does, but I think that's – but, you know, a key Jeffersonian principle is follow the truth wherever it might lead. He wrote that knowledge is power. He believed that we should fix reason firmly in her seat, as he once put it. So, you know, he hides in plain sight in many ways. And I think recovering his political life is it's fascinating, I think, because he was a public man in the most tumultuous and complicated times imaginable, a period of revolution, a period in which America, even after the revolution, even after Yorktown and the Treaty of Paris, underwent another 30 years or more of an existential crisis. There was no sense necessarily that the American experiment was firmly secure, which is an easy argument to win, frankly, because the British did come back. We did have the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. We had to ratify it. Mm-hmm. So the consuming concerns of his life were how do you build a republic and secure it? And that is a cultural undertaking. It's a philosophical undertaking, but it's also a political undertaking. And what makes him unique, I think, among the founders is that he was a master in each of those realms.
We'll look at the politics. We'll go past that to the morals. But plant us first. I mean, this was a man of the Enlightenment, thoroughly self-identified as such. What did that mean? Plant us in his philosophy to begin with, John.
The idea that what he encountered when he went to William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, in the early 1760s, what he found
there was for college.
Mm-hmm. What he found was a professor named William Small, who was a Scottish figure of the student of the Scottish Enlightenment. William Small is one of those figures whom virtually no American remembers. but without whom it's arguable we would be living in a different country, because he introduced Jefferson to the school of thought in which authority should not come from above, either in the forms of priests or kings or nobles, inherited nobles, hereditary nobles, but should rest with the people. And the sense that every person, for Jefferson that meant white man, of course, which we'll talk about,
yes,
but that every man was, you know, had a spark of divinity, had the capacity and the obligation to be a figure and a player in self-government.
So it's really William Small, in no small way, whose ideas are running through the Declaration of Independence that Jefferson would draft on that principle.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jefferson once said the three greatest men who ever lived were Newton, Bacon, and John Locke. Mm-hmm. And what runs through, what connects those three, by the way, when he said that, he was pointing out some portraits on the wall. Alexander Hamilton, who was a dinner guest, said Julius Caesar was the greatest man who ever lived.
Empire builder.
Well, yeah, one of the many things, and for all we know, Hamilton was worried that Jefferson would pull a Brutus. But anyway, that's a different story. What keeps Newton, Bacon, and Locke, what joins them together in their thinking, of course, is the role of reason, the capacity of human beings to live lives of progress, of forward motion, of discovery. And what Jefferson embodied in an intellectual way, and what he tried, I think largely successfully, to translate into political reality was he believed in the possibilities of human progress more than I think any other of the key founders in the early period.
More than George Washington.
More than Adams, certainly more than Hamilton. And there's something very American about that incarnation of the Enlightenment spirit. And I think Jefferson, whenever we think about tomorrow is going to be better than today, we have to sacrifice in order to invest in the future. Whenever we talk about hope and change, to coin a phrase, we're speaking a language, a vernacular that Jefferson helped forge at the very beginning.
He believed that, though, because he believed in the power of reason and he believed in the power of ordinary men in those days, but citizens, to exercise it effectively.
And history had taught him this. One of the things that I found so fascinating was I had not quite conjured with the significance, the cultural and political significance of the English Civil War for the founding generation. It was to them rather like what World War II is to us. There were phrases, allusions that were sprinkled in conversation that required no explanation. If you and I were to talk about Munich, Pearl Harbor, signing a surrender on the Missouri, you know, just phrases that for a lot of us have instant meaning. That was what the English Civil War was for the founders. And the Civil War offered a version of history that was incredibly cautionary for the Republicans, lowercase r, of the new United States, because you had a revolution that ended how? With a restoration of monarchy. And so this constant fear, this constant anxiety, this constant struggle to preserve the country, to try for the survival and success of Republican liberty was really, I think, a 50-year war for Jefferson and his contemporaries from the end of the French and Indian War all the way through to the Treaty of Ghent in 1815.
This reads like the fundamental political setting of this man, his big conflict with Alexander Hamilton, his face set against too much centralization of authority in the federal government. And yet, here's the guy who did the Louisiana Purchase. Here's the guy who threw down this huge embargo on trade with foreign powers. I mean, when he talked against centralization of authority, but he acted quite boldly when he had that authority.
And I know no one in life who does that. Do you? I know I don't.
But this is Thomas Jefferson. This is the founder.
But that's the point, Tom. That's precisely the point. This is Thomas Jefferson. This is a human being. This is a man in real time who, beyond all of our attempts to caricature him, to capture him, to mold him to our purposes, he was a living, breathing human being seeking power, dealing with constraints, trying to do the best he could, despite significant failings of moral character and of his own ability to be consistent, as you say. That's what's so fascinating to me. And I don't think we can learn from the past if we don't recognize it for what it was. We know how the story turned out. They didn't.
You're saying...
And they were men before they were monuments. And so why foreclose the possibility of being in a kind of conversation with the past by insisting either that they be all good or all bad?
A conversation, think, you're suggesting here that we could use again right now with this aspect of Thomas Jefferson in our politics.
I know we could. And I think part of it is that there are some perennial aspects to political struggle in the same way there are perennial aspects to human nature. And I am not saying that Thomas Jefferson would have a clear opinion on Obamacare. You know, I'm not being anachronistic in that way. But there are, in fact, recurring themes that I think he can inform for us.
John Meacham's big new biography is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. I'm Tom Ashbrook with John Meacham. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about politics and Thomas Jefferson. A new biography by John Meacham looks again at the master of Monticello, the drafter of the Declaration of Independence, the third president of the United States. It is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. The whole life is here, but with a special emphasis on the political life of Thomas Jefferson and its, shall we say, flexibility. He's been portrayed so many ways. Here's just a bit with this authority concern coming to mind from the HBO miniseries John Adams. Thomas Jefferson was played there by Stephen Delane, voicing his disappointment with Alexander Hamilton's interest in creating a national bank.
But I've been, as you know, in revolutionary France, where the streets are filled with the songs of liberty and brotherhood and the overthrow of ancient tyrannies of Europe, and to return from there to this, our cradle of revolution, and find the dinner table chatter is all of money and banks and authority is an unwelcome surprise.
John Meacham, take us back to the major political standoff of Thomas Jefferson's time so we can begin to see the many abundant echoes right now. But take us back.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jefferson comes back from revolutionary France in 1789. He becomes Secretary of State. He arrives back in Norfolk, Virginia, and discovers by the time he gets to Eppington on the way to Monticello that Washington wants him to be Secretary of State. He arrives in New York and quickly, as Jefferson said in one of his wonderful phrases, found himself with Alexander Hamilton daily pitted in the cabinet as two cocks. They were constantly at one another, and they both believed that they were fighting for the nature of, the definition of what America should be. Hamilton did believe in a larger role for the federal government. He believed in a more British form of power. Jefferson philosophically believed in a more Republican, lowercase r, role for government. As you pointed out, though, except when he was the one doing the expanding of government, which consistency was not one of his great political virtues. But I don't think consistency is much of a political virtue for most folks. The question that really divided the early Federalists and Republicans, which was, as Jefferson himself said, that men have divided themselves into parties since Greece and Rome over the question of whether the people should rule or the nobles. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he said. That was essentially the question on the table. And
that is, do we centralize in Washington or keep the power dispersed out through the country?
Is there a hereditary Senate? Is the president, should the presidency be hereditary? You know, these were live questions. We now live in with the virtue of 200 plus years of experience. They had none. And so all of this felt provisional. It all felt contingent. And what Jefferson believed in the American Revolution in the way I think of it almost in the way one believes in one's child. It was an organic, living thing that he had helped bring into being, that he was trying to raise, that he was trying to protect. And, you know, to the end of his days, he and John Adams spoke of it in reverential terms with an affection and a fondness and a respect that suggests to me that it was the defining issue in his mind, in his life. That he was committed to the principle of the survival and success of the country, but short of compromising on that principle, he would cut almost any deal. And he had an orientation toward a more Republican form than Hamilton had, but when it came to it in 1803, when presented with this immense opportunity to purchase Louisiana for virtually no money, essentially, to expand federal authority in a way that if Alexander Hamilton had tried to do it, his head would have exploded. Mm-hmm. But because he was there, he did it. And he later said that the strictest duty of the magistrate is to the law, but it's not the highest duty. The highest duty is to the survival of the country. Which was a way of looking at power, a practical way of looking at power that Abraham Lincoln drew on and that Franklin Roosevelt drew on. Franklin Roosevelt particularly pointed to the Louisiana Purchase mm-hmm. when he was trying to prepare the country for war with Britain. And I think that Jefferson, in spite of himself, in spite of representing this opposition to the Federalist interest, he became really the first imperial president.
So he wrote one way, he acted another, but his writing for decades and still now it seems behind an awful lot of American political tension. I mean, certainly through the rest of that century up until FDR. I mean, if you tried to do big things, people would pull out Jefferson and say, no, Washington should not be engaged in that.
That's right. And the secessionists wanted him, and then Franklin Roosevelt manages to use him. The people who were in favor of a free press, you know, Adolf Ochs of the New York Times endowed the Princeton paper, the Princeton Project for the Jefferson Papers during the bicentennial year. We built the Jefferson Memorial and opened it and dedicated it in 1943 in the middle of the great struggle for liberty. Only 80 years after Southern secessionists had been using Jefferson as a intellectual justification, as a folk hero to break the Union apart, a Union that was now trying to defend liberty around the world. So that's one of the great issues with Jefferson is everybody wants a piece of him. And James Parton, the great 19th century biographer, famously said that if America is right, then Jefferson is right. But if America's wrong, then Jefferson was wrong. That is a hell of a burden to put on any one person. You don't hear that about George Washington. You don't hear that about John Adams. You don't hear that about Alexander Hamilton.
But the Jeffersonian ideal is
– and because of the eloquence that you point out, yeah. I think part of the reason for that is his words echo in history because he wrote so beautifully.
Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power is John Meacham's big new biography. John, we've got callers lined up. Joe in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the line with John Meacham.
Hi, Tom. Mr. Meacham's touching on my comment and my question right now. Perhaps no other founder is more universally claimed by both the left and the right and the center than Thomas Jefferson, particularly because of his views of anti-federalist views to some extent, and particularly because as the left would claim him as an enlightened man. So I would wonder if Mr. Mitchum could expound upon that dichotomy a bit.
Yeah, to take it on, John. I mean, it is interesting. We have a different, you know, the Enlightenment has not been the most popular among our anti-federalists lately. But
yes,
Jefferson put those two things together, and everybody wants to claim him, says Joe.
Everybody wants to claim him, and it's a complicated business. You know, when we reach back for heroes or for intellectual justification. When we look back, we're almost always trying to find someone who reaffirms our pre-existing inclinations, right? We, you know, find me a quote, see if Lincoln approved of X, you know. Give me something. And that's understandable, but it's not very good history, ultimately. And what I think we have to do with Jefferson is realize that he lived more than 80 years. He wrote a gazillion. That's a technical historical term.
Yes.
I don't want to overwhelm you with my academic learning
right
now. A gazillion letters that were incredibly – are still incredibly resonant. He's a little like Winston Churchill and the Bible in that he is articulate on so many different issues and for over such a long period of time that you can quote him on either side of almost anything. The way I approach this question of who is the real Jefferson, is he a conservative, is he a liberal, is he a moderate, would he be on Simpson Bowles' side or would he be – is that that's actually not the right question. It's unanswerable. What we have to recover is who he was in real time. Put ourselves in his very well-crafted English shoes and try to see the world as he saw it. And what he saw was that we live in a fallen, complicated, often confounding world, that we have to do everything we can to preserve human liberty so that individual rights, individual liberties, the pursuit of reason cannot be taken away by either the hand of a king or the hands of a mob. And that sense of the centrality of freedom, of liberty under law, is the one thing that I think we can safely point back to and say this was Jefferson. And I also want to say
– with the great slavery exception standing right at
well,
the shoulder.
Well, because he was a – yes, because he was a human being and his life was
not
made –
not all human beings own slaves.
No, but a lot of Southern planters did, which is what he was. And it took 80 more years after he – 60 more – 40 more years after he died to adjudicate something and 600,000 American lives in the Civil War. I'm not defending Jefferson and slavery by any means, but I think it has to be seen in its full context, which is his life was made possible by slavery. His first memory was of being handed up to a slave on a horse
his
with Jefferson himself
way
on a pillow.
Of life, you mean. His way of life, his standard of living, not his life itself, surely.
No, I don't know that I agree with it. I mean, I think that his whole – yes, his way of life, his – but I'm not sure I would draw that line.
His particular life, certainly.
His life, his world was economically, culturally, sexually, was all inextricably linked to slavery. And so we can't close that off as some kind of compartment. We can't say that's one part of him. It suffused everything. But – we live in a country that for much of its history, all too much of its history, not only condoned it but encouraged to some extent and perpetuated an institution that was the embodiment of evil. But so many people were complicit in it that I think to – say that slave owners don't speak to us now or aren't should not be examined and thought about and talked about is to foreclose the possibility of learning from the past. You know, Arthur Schlesinger used to say that self-righteousness in retrospect was easy, also cheap.
Yes, very. Yes, both.
And I don't want to just wag my finger at the – I mean I might feel better by wagging my finger at the past, but what I think we have to do is – take the moral failings of Thomas Jefferson, take the moral failings of so many of people in the past, and instead of feeling superior to them, which is very easy to do, have a sense of what will the future say about us? What are the problems of our time that about which we might have a finger wagged at us? And let's do something about those.
We'll get instant humility from that exercise, I'd say. Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts, you're on the air with John Meacham. Thanks for calling, Bill.
My pleasure. I want to come to Hamilton's defense. One, he was totally correct when it came to the National Bank. He was absolutely against slavery. He was a war hero, which, by the way, Jefferson went over backwards not to serve in that particular war. But most important, everybody has this impression about Hamilton wanting to suppress the common man or feeling that there should be some sort of higher-up aristocracy. Hamilton was a person who believed in merit and that anyone who had merit could rise to the top. By contrast, yes, Jefferson did believe that the common man should have rights and all that, but he also had this attitude that people down below should stay down below because that was their class. In other words, they should be respected, they should have their rights and all that, but that the upper crust did have, how should I put it, their place, and their place was above the rest.
Bill, let us pick it up right there. John Meacham, what do you say to that depiction?
It's very interesting, and Hamilton has much to teach us. I think and Ron Chernow has written wonderfully about him, and I think that the Jefferson-Hamilton battles are fascinating, and I don't think you have to – I actually don't think you have to choose one or the other. So let me stipulate that. You know, it would and Hamilton was, in fact, the embodiment of social mobility given his origins. Mm. And he helped make possible a universe that and a culture where people could rise. But so did Jefferson. You know, Jefferson struck the deal that made the federal government assume the debts of the states in exchange for the capital on the Potomac. Mm. At a moment when Hamilton and James Madison were at loggerheads, and that Hamilton thought the government itself was at risk, it was Jefferson who came in and convened a dinner, made the deal, made it happen. The other thing I'd say about the idea that somehow or another Jefferson believed in absolute ranks of people. You know, John Adams would disagree. You know, part of their late-in-life correspondence, you know, they were the great frenemies mm-hmm. in American history, was about this question of, you know, whether there was a class of people who should be the rulers. And Jefferson took the more democratic side of that argument, as opposed to John Adams, who did not. So I think there's a lot to be said for Jefferson's blind spots. I think ultimately, he helped create, preserve, perpetuate a government, a culture where the voice of the many had a place as well as the voice of the few.
And something in the way he did that, you're encouraging politicians right now to take another look at. We'll come back and look at that, but we've got 30 seconds before the break. What's the beginning of what you'd like to see adopted, picked up, reviewed in Jefferson's political style?
Well, I think a point you made wonderfully a minute ago, and that's the role of reason. You know, that history is not should not simply be life should not simply be about reaffirming what we already believe. That we have to allow contrary facts, unfolding dramas, changing situations, and to fix reason firmly in her seat and not simply to commit ourselves to a single course and then not change our minds or believe that somehow or another the life of the mind is separate from the life of the nation. They're intimately connected. Mm. And I think that's a critical Jeffersonian legacy that is all too often ignored.
Reason and politics, we know today how they can drift apart. John Meacham's big new book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. Jefferson loved Vivaldi, loved Four Seasons, number one, spring. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about politics and Thomas Jefferson. A new biography by John Meacham looks again at the master of Monticello and the drafter of the Declaration of Independence, the third president of the United States. It is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. The whole life is there with a special focus on how Jefferson handled his very active political life. Two-term president, third president of the United States, came in after a tie was broken, an electoral tie between himself and Aaron Burr. John, you've got a little bit of Jefferson's language himself there, for I think his first inaugural, to get a sense of the man right into our ears here. His first inaugural address when he said that he had a mandate from the people to fight against those in the government who opposed him. But he was, it sounds very modest the way he puts it in the inaugural.
Well, he does. It was Wednesday, March 4th, 1801. He had won on the 36th ballot in the House.
So, to break this tie. Mm-hmm.
To break a tie, which makes the 2000 election look like a landslide.
Cakewalk, yeah.
In many ways. And it's a brief for freedom and forbearance. It's a remarkable document. He wrote it, you know, he was lucky because he was a poor public speaker. He was lucky to live in an era in which the written word was the central means of communication. You know, he mastered that in the way that Franklin Roosevelt mastered radio and mm-hmm. Kennedy and Reagan mastered television, and Barack Obama clearly has mastered the internet.
And he did not speak often as president.
Not at all. And in fact, he gave up State of the Union addresses, partly because he didn't speak well, but also partly because he thought it was too royalist for mm-hmm. the president to present something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's just read one thing that I think is an unusually key. When I heard President Obama the other night say, "I am a better president because I have listened to you," mm-hmm. talking to the people who had voted against him.
And I haven't been a perfect president and I won't be.
There was bells went off in my head. And mm-hmm. here's what Thomas Jefferson said in 1801. He said, "Sometimes it is said that man cannot be trusted with the government of himself. Can he then be trusted with the government of others? Or have we found angels in the forms of kings to govern him? Let history answer this question. I repair then, fellow citizens, to the post you have assigned me, with experience enough in subordinate offices to have seen the difficulties of this, the greatest of all. I have learnt to expect that it will rarely fall to the lot of imperfect man to retire from this station with the reputation and the favor which bring him into it. I shall often go wrong through defect of judgment. When right, I shall often be thought wrong by those whose positions will not command a view of the whole ground. I ask your indulgence for my own errors, which will never be intentional, and your support against the errors of others who may condemn what they would not if seen in all its parts." That's a remarkably candid ask, as we would say.
Yes, it is. And nuanced ask about human nature from the inaugural podium there.
Saying, give me a break, I'm not going to get this right all the time. And it's – you used a word a minute ago that I think is so important, which is humility. And I do think President Obama has, you know, with his interest in Reinhold Niebuhr and that tradition, I think there is something that – we, you know, pride goeth before a fall, as it says in the Proverbs, which is one part of the Bible which Jefferson didn't try to edit.
Right. That's only the New
thing.
Testament.
That's right. Talk about editorial ego.
Yeah.
But I think that's, you know, if every public official read that, took that to heart, and if every one of us listened to it, because it's not just about leadership in this yes. country, in a democracy, it's about followership. To what extent are political leaders a maker or a mirror of public opinion and public willingness to do something?
But I look at that, Monticello and the man who edited the Bible and the Sally mm-hmm. Hemingster, I don't see a paragon of humility first and foremost here. I mean, this was a man who had put a lot of faith in his own thinking. And you write that he was very willing to act on it. I mean, and to act boldly. Louisiana Purchase, not least. Declaration of Independence, not least.
He did, but he also understood that it was an imperfect world and that there were always going to be critics. Like all politicians, he hated criticism, though he went into a business that only has it.
Yeah.
But, you know, he says there, "I shall often go wrong through defect of judgment." I mean, he admits that he's going to make mistakes. You could call it the doctrine of preemptive mistakes were made.
Right.
So there's a sense, and let's be very clear. he had, you know, he could be quite cynical and calculating.
Talk about that. You know, talk about his and I don't mean that's all of it, but talk about his actual exercise of power. As we sit here at the beginning of a second term for a sitting president, if President Obama were to think about the art of power as exercised here, if John Boehner were to think about it, what would you have them take from Jefferson?
There are two things that I think are most important, which is one is you have to be daring. You have to understand that the clock is ticking, that these are perishable hours.
Of power.
Of power. And Thomas Jefferson, I think the great example of his mastering the art of political power and leadership is the Louisiana Purchase, which he undertook in 1803, I think in part because, as a caller just mentioned, he had had a disastrous run as governor of Virginia during the Revolutionary War when he had been too slow to call out the militia to fight off the British invasion.
He had not covered himself in glory. He paid for that for the rest of his
life. And he lived with – oh, my God. It drove him crazy the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. Again, that's a technical historical term. And he never wanted to feel that way again. And so Louisiana comes up. It sort of, you know, it basically falls into our laps. And he agrees in the middle of July, in early July 1803, to accept the deal, but decides there's going to be a constitutional amendment. There's got to be a, you know, the Constitution does not give the president the power to double the size of the country, that his strict constructionist views, as opposed to Hamilton's broad ones, mean that he has to go to the people. Then around the 21st, I think, or so of August 1803, he gets another letter saying that Napoleon is rethinking the deal. By the 23rd of August, he has decided we shall not scruple about the constitutional issues at stake and just decides to take it. Take it. Never mind. What constitutional amendment? And he did that because he believed it was for the strengthening of the country and that circumstances had changed. And so
what's the lesson there? Guantanamo stays open.
Well, that's the risk.
Forget the FISA court.
That's the danger. The danger of, you know, a powerful president is if you agree with that powerful president, let's say, Abraham Lincoln. When Abraham Lincoln was assuming great powers and pushing forward trying to preserve the Union, we approve of that imperial power. Mm. When we think about Franklin Roosevelt, who did, you know, seized enormous powers, we tend to approve of that, except when we don't.
So is it matters of reach and overreach where Obama, where Boehner might pay closest attention, or is it in compromise, John?
I believe that ultimately it's compromise because I think we've defined more or less the acceptable boundaries of executive power. We know, you know, these things bounce back and forth. We went too far in the last 10 years in many ways. I think people accept that. And I think that we have to tend to – and we historically we've managed to sort of find the right way ultimately despite the fact that we have – gone too far in an authoritarian direction. Leaving that aside, I think what you just said is exactly right, which is what Jefferson did every night when he was in Washington, when Congress was in session, is he had dinner with congressional members of Congress. He didn't have – this was not a kumbaya kind of thing. This was not a Simpson Bowles plenary session. He did not have Republicans and Federalists come in so that everyone could get along. He had only Federalists or only Republicans because he was weaving attachments to him. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want the table to erupt in political quarreling. He believed, as Gordon Wood and others have argued quite brilliantly, he believed that sociability was a key Republican virtue, that if we didn't like each other, if we didn't care about each other's fates, a republic was not going to work. So what I think the president can learn, what I think Speaker Boehner can learn, what I think any president, any speaker going forward can learn is that, as Jefferson said, sometimes it is best to give as well as to take in a system like ours. And that until we find a more perfectible system, this is the one we've got. And being able to achieve a climate of trust and trust enough and faith in one another enough that we can give each other the benefit of the doubt from time to time is a way of finding the means to make mutual concessions, without which we're not going to make it. A democracy, a republic, cannot survive without mutual concessions of opinion. The middle way is not always the right way, by any means, of course. We know that. But sometimes it is. And what we don't have now is a climate in which people are willing to – lawmakers are willing to give the other side the benefit of the doubt.
Did Thomas Jefferson leave the Civil War in Abraham Lincoln's lap with his signing into law the bill that legalized slavery in the vast new territories that he had acquired for the United States?
You know, Jefferson had tried once he tried four or five times to reform slavery as a young man. He stopped about 1784 because he had drafted language that would have prohibited it going forward. And it lost by a single vote in the Confederation Congress. Jefferson predictably wrote wonderfully about it, that heaven was silent in that awful moment, talking about that loss. And I think one of the reasons he ceased his attempts at emancipation and for him what would have been repatriation and recolonization was that he had lost publicly and decisively in three or four or five cases as a young man, both as a lawyer and as a legislator. So that was the story of his – the story of Jefferson and slavery after 1785 becomes a grimmer tale.
How he paid for his interests after that.
I mean, exactly. And certainly the question of territorial expansion and the role of slavery was going to fuel the fires that ultimately led to the Civil War. But that – what I would also say is that was of a piece with the Three-Fifths Compromise that had been present in the Constitution and of a piece with the sentiment in the Continental Congress in Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia in 1776 that led the lawmakers to cut out passages of Jefferson's denouncing slavery. So, you know, the American story is inextricably shaped and stained by two great original sins, African slavery and the removal of Native Americans. Jefferson played a significant role in both those things. My argument is that his failings in that case are also the country's, and that we have to understand both the country's tendencies and his own in order to get a sense of what life was really like then.
A listener asks online about the Great Awakening, the great revival of religiosity that would occur later as the 19th century rolled forward. And the listener asks, did Jefferson have anything to say about the Great Awakening, or was he blissfully unaware of what this listener calls that horrid turn away from decent Enlightenment values? What about his deep grounding was in the Enlightenment? We saw something else grew up alongside that founder's impulse in the 19th century that was very powerful. Did he see that coming?
This seems
relevant today when some Enlightenment values seem deep in our rearview mirror now.
Jefferson reminds me sometimes of what was said of Winston Churchill occasionally, which was, when Winston's right, he's right, but when he's wrong, my God. When Jefferson was right, he was right, but when he was wrong, my God. He once said in this period, in his retirement, that he believed that very soon there was not a young man living in the United States who would not die a Unitarian. That was not the best of predictions, as things turned out. His sense of it's a terrific question, because the first Great Awakening played a hugely important role, I think, and scholars believe, in creating a culture that emphasized the individual, which with the addition of classical Republican thought coming through the Renaissance, the Florentine Renaissance, and the English sense, the Whig sense of history were all these rivulets, these tributaries forming the river of the intellectual climate of the American Revolution. And so the first Great Awakening certainly played that role. The second Great Awakening for Jefferson was a source of – I mean, haute religiosity was something that Jefferson was very uncomfortable – made uncomfortable by. And had a fight, one of his first fights, I think his literally the first fight at the University of Virginia was he wanted to have a Unitarian professor, and the state legislature rebelled. And so he worried all the time about the tension between reason and religion. He called the Trinity and other parts of Christian doctrine the mere abracadabra of the men calling themselves priests of Jesus. You know, he was very tough on what I would call sort of post-second century Christianity, and believed, and in fact, as you pointed out, created his own Bible in a way, talking about the life and morals of Jesus, believing that, as Benjamin Franklin once said, that the life and morals of Jesus as he left them to us were the best that man had ever seen, but that it had received various corrupting changes by institutions. And that is of a piece with his worldview, which was when priests, when prelates, when princes were in charge, things moved in a direction, in an unhealthy direction. When the people were in charge, working through the institutions of republicanism, we stood a better chance to live lives of virtue and reason.
Well, it's a complicated world. Then we got our Great Awakening, and the people had their say as well, not exactly in a Unitarian direction, as it turned out. John Meacham, we're very grateful to you for the new book, for all of your work and thinking here, and for your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Tom, this was great. Thank you.
John Meacham, author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. Jefferson loved Arcangelo Corelli, favorite composer, claimed it influenced his own violin playing. Here's a little of that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.